At a time when politics seems dominated by rancor and partisanship, this from retiring Iowa Representative Kurt Swaim.
I really do love you all. I love you all.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and in the first half hour, we'll talk with two lawmakers retiring from the Iowa House of Representatives, Democrat Kurt Swaim and Republican Lance Horbach. Then in the second half hour, my guest is longtime Associated Press reporter Mike Glover. Glover retired last month after 36 years of working for the AP in Des Moines. We'll hear some of his reflections on how politics and the print media have changed over the decades. That's all coming up this hour, right after the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Iowa legislature was scheduled to adjourn some 3 weeks ago. They're still in session. However, legislative leaders are expressing confidence they can finish their protracted budget talks and adjourn this week. This despite an ongoing dispute over proposed property tax reductions. Joining us this hour, two lawmakers from the Iowa House of Representatives who are counting down their final days as state lawmakers. They are retiring after this session. Joining us from the law library at the state capitol, Representative Lance Horbach, a Republican from Tama. He was elected first in 1997. Representative Horbach, welcome.
Hey, thank you.
Also joining Representative Horbach, Representative Kurt Swaim, a Democrat from Bloomfield, serving in the legislature since 2003. Representative Swaim, welcome to our program.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for the invitation.
Glad to have both of you on to share some of your reflections of the time you've held in office, looking back. But before we do that, I wonder if either of you can give us a quick update on how the session is wrapping up. Are you both optimistic it will be this week?
Ben, nobody knows for sure. Lance and I were just discussing beforehand. You would think that we might know, but it does appear as if things are coming together. I think that all the conference committees have essentially agreed in principle, except with the exception of two. The standings committee is still discussing some points, as well as the DHS budget committee. But I think that they're in agreement in terms of the numbers, and it's a matter of some of the policy issues that they'll be discussing. So I think that there's a roadmap to get out of here, whether it'll be Wednesday or not. I would not hazard a guess on that one.
Representative Horbach, anything to add to that?
Well, I would agree with what Representative Swaim said. I know that the target date for us was get rooms through Wednesday, so that's kind of their target date. I will tell you, though, from the retirement side, from both of us, I know we were just talking about this issue before you asked the question, and my wife said, you know, is this the final week now? Because we've been told the final week was going to be the first or second week in April, and then every week after that, we just keep coming back and coming back. So hopefully it'll all be resolved by Wednesday of this week.
Mm-hmm. Each of you have many legislative sessions to look back on. Any good words to characterize this specific session compared to others?
Well, Ben, you know, I think that there's, there's been an effort on both parties to come together, and I think that we're coming together. Democracy takes a lot of patience sometimes, and when you have a stalemate, there's a lot of frustrations, and those frustrations boil to the top. And if you kind of keep in mind that it's a matter of commitment, you know, there are a lot of people with very strong commitments here in the House, and so it takes time to sort of resolve the rough edges. And so I think that once again, you know, it's a challenge, but we always seem to come together at the end. And I think we're headed in that direction this year, too.
I think what made this year different is Representative Swaim and myself have qualities that are very parallel to each other. We've both been asked by our parties to run very controversial bills throughout our career. But at the same time, I think we're both considered middle of the road, he a Democrat, me a Republican. And this year, with the stalemate with Republican in the House and Democrat in the Senate, we haven't had those controversial bills. We've had bills that have, for the most part, that are moving forward, that are at least getting signed, are the things that almost all Iowans can agree on. For for sure the legislators can agree on. So we've had a year that actually had a lower number of bills, but still the stumbling block remains, and it still is, the budget bills, which are very quickly, hopefully, being resolved.
Lance Horbach with us, along with Kurt Swaim. If you'd like to join our conversation with these two retiring Iowa lawmakers, join our conversation at 1-866-780-9100. River-to-River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, and you can give us a tweet at, if you choose, at IPR Talk. Let me hear from both of you, please. Representative Horbach, first of all, why are you retiring?
Why am I retiring? Well, you know, I have to tell you that I have had just an honor to be here 14 years, and it really gets in your blood. So there's a little bit of bittersweet as I sit here today in front of you, but there's a lot of people behind each one of us, Representative Swaim and myself, who have had to make sacrifices so that we can serve. There's my wife, my kids, my family, my employer, and there's a lot of things that have actually arisen to a different height that have caused me to make this decision. I want to be able to do right with my family as far as provide them with a decent living, be around when I need to be around, and so I think it's just the right time.
Mm-hmm. Representative Swaim?
My thoughts echo a lot of Lance's, Representative Horbach's. We were just talking before we went on that he had a productive weekend because he got quite a lot of honeydew things done, and I think I have about 10 years worth of honeydew things back home. But realistically, it's been a great honor to serve. It's been the greatest 10 years of my life. I just appreciate the chance to serve. But at the same time, I have grandkids back home and around, and hope to make a lot more ball games and dance recitals than I have in the past.
Mm-hmm. Representative Swaim and Representative Horbach, we do spend a lot of time on this program. You've taken part in programs in the past. We talk about political disputes most of the time when it involves politics. Also, some nastiness works its way in there, goes along with politics. We know that. So we were struck by your comments, Representative Swaim, in your retirement speech on the floor of the Iowa House. You spoke specifically to your colleagues and your staff on both sides of the aisle. We have a bit of audio of that. Let's listen.
I really do love you all. I love you all. In terms of, and because of that, I won't sing to you. But in the sense of having a fond admiration for each of you, in terms of respecting your integrity, your commitment to your jobs, to the state of Iowa, and in the sense of just really wishing you all well, I really do love you all, and I'll miss you.
Representative Swaim, very nice heartfelt sentiments. Did those come to you right at the podium as you stepped up there?
They really did. They were genuine, and they were just the remarks that came to mind and the way that I felt as I looked at the colleagues across the chamber. I mean, I think that Iowans overall would be very proud if they were inside and knew the level of commitment on the part of representatives on both sides of the aisle. I mean, just a tremendous passion, tremendous commitment, and tremendous commitment to the state of Iowa. And I think that sometimes we overstate the dissension. I mean, yes, there are strong feelings and strong convictions on both sides and difference in philosophies, but overall, you know, we're all Iowans. We basically attend the same schools and we go to the same churches and synagogues and we come to the legislature with the same values and maybe perhaps a little different political philosophies, but the same commitment to the state of Iowa. And I think that sometimes some of the political dialogue, we miss the commonality among the legislatures. I was just thinking as I drove up here that we think political dissension is sort of new to our age, but it never is. I remember Ben Franklin famously disinherited his son, who was a Tory, loyal to the crown, in his will by saying that he left all of his land that he, Ben Franklin, owned in Nova Scotia to his son. Of course, Ben Franklin didn't own any land in Nova Scotia. But, you know, there have been always strong convictions and political divisions, even within families sometimes. And so I think that that's nothing new to the political process, and we can survive that. And I think that we can all be better as long as we continue to respect one another.
Representative Horbach, do these words of your colleague, Kurt Swaim, strike a chord with you too?
Oh, I have 100%. I'm in 100% agreement with Representative Swaim. I think, you know, when you asked him if his words came to him right when he was standing there, the irony is when we both and all the legislators who are here, we come in, and when we're first elected, we feel we are here to save the world. We're going to change the world, make a difference. And then as time goes on, you look in our law books, and never once will you see Representative Swaim's name. You will not see Representative Horbach's name. You understand that it takes 51. And so the pleasures and the joys that we have are actually helping our citizens. I mean, I can remember, and I know Representative Swaim will have a long list as well, but a young little baby who was having difficulties and they couldn't get through the bureaucracy to get assistance, or maybe somebody filled out a form wrong at workforce development, couldn't get unemployment, they called us. Those are the personal rewards that we have. And so when it comes to writing your speech, you know, you change as a legislator as your career gets older, and you understand that you aren't maybe as important singularly as you are being able to communicate and work with others.
Interesting that you mentioned that, Representative Horbach, about how you have changed over the years. Let me put it to both of you this way, to you, Representative Swaim, first of all. If you could revisit yourself as a freshman representative back in, 2003, visit you in another form, sort of a Ghost of Marley thing going on here. That first day or that first week at the legislature, you pull that younger version of yourself aside and you have some sage advice, what would it be?
Well, my comments would just echo Lance's, really. I mean, we come in as freshman legislators thinking that we can accomplish more than we realistically can. And when you're dealing with 150 legislators with each their own agenda, you have to work within the system, and I think that's the basic thing that is the learning curve as you start the process. I know Mike Glover is going to be your guest later, and I remember a speech that he gave to the legislature one time, Ben, and he spoke about the importance of relationships in terms of the process, and I think that's very true. I mean, I have the world of respect for Lance Horbach. I mean, he is just he is the model of morality in the legislature. And when he says something, his word means his bond. And when you have that reputation and that experience in the legislature, you can be a very effective legislator because people listen to you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Horbach, is it true that in 1997 that you won by only 2 votes?
Partially true. 1998, November of 1998, it was election night, and I was sitting at home because I didn't think we'd lose, so I just had a few close friends, and the courthouse called and said, it's official, you've won by 75 votes. So we celebrated, a few tears, hugs, and then 15 minutes later, they called and said, we miscounted, you're still ahead, but you're ahead by 2 votes. So I actually went through the same process that the presidents went through in Florida. And so for 3 weeks, I didn't know if I'd won or lost. So it actually, in the recount, and this is the irony of it, in the recount, I ended up winning by 7 votes. So the outgoing governor, who was Branstad, nicknamed me Landslide Lance, and that's kind of stuck here until they've gotten to know me a little better. So, yes, that is true.
Has a nice ring to it, too.
Yes, it does.
What about the level of partisanship that you have seen over the years in your tenures? Has that increased?
I'll go first on this one. I think partisanship will play wherever it's allowed. I have to tell you that quite often the newspapers and media seek out the people who are way to the right or way to the left as to that's the message and that's the detail of what's going on today at the Capitol. When the fact of the matter is, when you ask Representative Swaim what we've learned and what we've, when we first came in, what would you tell yourself differently? I think we've both learned that you never burn a bridge. You have the ability to talk to them because they're just people just like you, whether it's your leader or your partisan advocate on the other side, we have the opportunity to work together. And I think that is overreaching everything else that's seen on the outside as being extreme on both sides. And that happens every day. Wouldn't you agree, Representative Swain?
Yes, very much so.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned the media. Are you saying perhaps that the media has changed somewhat in this time to seeking out the dog fights rather than perhaps more important stories?
Well, if I was in the media, I'd sure seek it out because, you know, news that makes you boil or gets you fired up is really what helps sell. And it doesn't sell that, you know, Representative Swaim and Representative Horbach sat today downstairs in the basement and tried to work this plan out. That doesn't sell. But when you get the extremes on each side, that does sell. And, you know, one of the things that I think we've both learned as senior legislators is to let that go to the wayside and not get in the way and make sure that we keep talking and working things out together, which Representative Swaim and I have had that opportunity to do for many years.
I think some of our listeners would wonder about the difference between being a representative at a state level and then at a national level. Do you have any words that can help us understand how that is different?
Well, Ben, you know, at the state level, we are what is commonly called the citizen legislators. I mean, we go back home. We typically have our own jobs back home. And I strongly believe in a citizen legislature because I think that helps you very much keep in touch with the locals. You know, some things that sound great under the domes don't always play so well back home. And so I think that's a very important input that we have because we're constantly going home on weekends and then when the legislature's not in session. And so I think that we do, but just because of that, we are able to keep in touch and keep a little more oriented toward the local base.
Mm-hmm. I would answer that by saying they know where we live. our phone number is in the book. We buy groceries where they buy groceries. So the ability to communicate is readily available. And that is not, you know, that is not an option for at the federal level. And taking it to another extreme, if you go down to the county government level, they're there every day. You have to travel to Des Moines to talk to us, and sometimes we don't get the communication that we'd like. So the actual participation actually goes up the closer you get to the people. And so since we're closer than the federal government, I think that we have the opportunity to hear their voice better than the federal government. But at the same time, we recognize that the county supervisors or even the city councils and the school boards actually have that's where the biggest benefit of the people and their participation level is the highest.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with all that, Ben. Going back to your question a little bit in terms of whether or not the partisanship has increased, I would say that over the 10 years I've been in the legislature that I don't know if the partisanship has increased more or not, more or less, but that I think that the citizenry, the people are a little more, that there are more people on both ends of the extremes of the spectrum was when I began.
Well, what about your respective parties? How would you say they have changed in nature in the last 10 or 15 years?
Well, I think that we
have they gone also to the extremes? I mean, we talk about the middle ground, especially in national politics, disappearing, the moderates of both parties.
I think that the legislators are generally reflective of the citizenry. And so I think that to the extent that the people have become a little bit more focused on the ends of the spectrum, I think that there are more legislators that are less focused on the moderate position.
Mm-hmm. Representative Horbach, you spoke of, I believe, being a moderate in your party. Is that something that's disappearing at a state level too?
I don't think so. And when I say moderate, that moderate up here means you're willing to listen. You'll have an open mind, and it's not the moderate that you would think of in an election process where maybe my views are more liberal. But that I want to make that distinction. I also would say that Well, I guess I lost my track of thought. But anyway, that's really moderate. It has a different meaning up here. It means someone that'll work with you and won't throw up the hardcore lines. I will tell you what has changed in my career. When I was first sitting at my desk, a page would come down to you and say that you have a phone call, Representative Horbach, and there's a phone booth in the back, and you go back and get it. And then they changed that to a phone at our desk with a blinking light. And now with the emails that are going out, everybody has instant access. And so we have access to our people back home. We also have access to the partisanship of, you know, the people who are emailing us usually are the people who are paying attention. Because I got to tell you, in my district, and I think in Representative Swaim, when we door knock, most of the people say, just stay out of my life. Don't screw it up. You know what I mean? So what we hear from are the people who are impacted greatly, that they're depending on government for some reason, or they're the extreme on the other side.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I wanted to give you each a chance, perhaps share a favorite memory or a highlight, a little story, if you'd like. Either one of you want to jump in first?
You know what? Since this is about my retirement, I'd like to – this is on my phone, and this is another reason why I'm retiring, but I want to play this for you.
Grandpa, come home. I know that is from your speech, isn't it?
That's from my speech. I've saved that on my phone. And afterwards, I said, I had to explain to my granddaughter, this was 2 years ago, I said, Grandpa is here to make the world better. And she had the perfect answer, which was, if you came home and were with me, my world would be better. And that really took hold. So that's my one story that I'd like to leave you with.
Wow, that is a nice story. Looking forward to future times with your granddaughter. Representative Swaim, what about you? A favorite story?
Wow, that's impossible to match. I won't even attempt to try. But I would just, you know, if I think back, I just think of the wonderful people that I've met that I would not have otherwise have met if I had not been a legislator. Mm-hmm. I mean, the legislators, I think the world of, but the constituents, you know, people in my district, I would not have known. And these are people that have tremendous commitment, tremendous belief in the system, and tremendous respect and the idea that they can make a difference. And I'm just so thankful to have had those people as a part of my life.
Mm-hmm. Representative Swaim, what will you be doing with your extra time?
Well, I have a law practice back in Bloomfield, so I've got some attention that it needs, and as I mentioned, about 10 years of honeydew projects and some grandkids mm-hmm. that I'm looking forward to seeing more often.
Representative Horbach, how old is your granddaughter we just heard there?
Well, this granddaughter is 5, but there are 13, 9, 9, 5, and 2, so I've got a lot to look forward to.
Okay, very good. What would you say would be the lessons learned? Perhaps you could extend those lessons to younger lawmakers who are just starting out.
Well, my advice would be, I don't care who you are, whether you're a legislator or you're a concerned citizen, people can make a difference. Be respectful, never burn a bridge, and be true to yourself, because once you start giving up your principles, there is a loss of respect from the rest of the people. Even though there's times Representative Swaim and I have disagreed, we have never lost respect for each other, because we know we're doing it for the right reasons. It's not partisan. It's what we have inside us. And I think that that's not just legislators. That's people back home trying to make their community or even their home better. That would be my advice.
Very well put.
Representative Swaim, the final words for you?
Well, I just think that sometimes up here you can feel insignificant, because sometimes the problems seem challenging beyond your ability. But, I mean, I think that that's just what we're called to do as representatives and senators and citizens, to just do the best that we can. And we tend to always come out well when everybody does that.
Representative Kurt Swaim, Democrat from Bloomfield. Representative Lance Horbach, Republican from Tama. We thank you for your service, and we wish you all the best in your retirement. When we come back here on River to River, as mentioned, my guest is longtime Associated Press reporter Mike Glover. Glover retired last month after 36 years of working for the AP in Des Moines. We'll hear about his reflections on how politics and the print media have changed over the decades. When we return, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and my guest this half hour is longtime Associated Press reporter Mike Glover. Glover retired last month from his position as senior legislative and political correspondent for the AP in Des Moines. He's covered the State House and Iowa politics for the AP for 36 years. He joins us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Mike, welcome back to our program.
Well, thanks a lot, Ben. I appreciate it. Nice to be here.
Now, let's see. If my math's correct, that puts us in the mid-70s when you started for the AP in Des Moines, in the middle of the Robert Ray governorship era, correct?
Yes. Robert Ray was governor when I began working, yes.
What do you recall of those first days on the job?
Oh, it's a new adjustment. Always, a state house is a different kind of an animal than almost any other place in the world. And a lot of adjustments, a lot of getting used to. It was fortunate to start under the Bob Ray administration because Ray has kept with, I think, what is a fairly important and nice tradition of Iowa politics, which is openness. Iowa politics is fairly open compared to many states that I've been around. Mm-hmm. You can actually get information from people. Most of the top newsmakers have regular meetings with reporters, and your questions get answered pretty quickly. It's not that way in a lot of other states.
Nevertheless, Iowa has changed undoubtedly in on the political landscape. How would you say in 30-some years it has changed? The openness has stayed more or less.
The openness has stayed more or less, but the one thing that I think has changed most during my time in Iowa politics is the influence that the Iowa caucuses have had on the state's political climate, political calendar, political agenda, and importance in politics nationally. Mm-hmm. That didn't really begin until about it started a little bit in 1972, and in 1976, Iowa played a very important role in Jimmy Carter's campaign. And since then, the Iowa caucuses have more or less set the stage for the political climate of this state. It's made this state a very, very active political state, more activity going on and more than in almost any other state. Iowa's one of two or three states in the country that play that kind of a role in presidential politics and get that sort of attention.
If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps a question or a comment for Mike Glover, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. As a matter of fact, Mike, you have been assigned by the AP to cover several presidential candidates over the years to be one of the so-called boys on the bus. Tell us about a memorable campaign that you covered that sticks out.
Oh, I think probably one of the more memorable nights was with Al Gore before the 2000 campaign. We were in Florida and then a couple of other states and then got to Nashville at about 7 in the morning. So there was no sleep that night. And then we all know what happened on the night of election 2000. I was actually writing the overnight roundup, and I called the desk in Washington. I said, how do we write a lead that says we just had an election and we don't know who won? And they said, good luck with that, Mike. We've never written it before.
And how did you end up straddling that fence?
I straddled that fence as best I could by saying, basically, we just had an election and we don't know who won.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to observe the inner circle of Al Gore's team there during those trying days for not only the campaign but for the country?
Yeah, it was no, you didn't. There was not a lot of public activity because it was all going on in courts, in closed strategy sessions. Publicly, the campaigns were not saying very much, and publicly, the campaigns scattered to the winds. So it was, and of course, it was the biggest story in the world. So I wasn't the only person trying to find out.
Right.
But so it was a very, very strange process, a very strange a month or so in American politics, where the whole future of the country kind of hang in the balance.
Mm-hmm. Well, other presidential contenders that you've covered that come to mind?
Oh, John Kerry. I spent a lot of time with John Kerry in 2004. And I learned an old lesson in politics. I think people who pay attention to politics should learn earlier in their career. And that is, politics is all about who you like and who you don't like. People can be very talented. People can be very bright. People can bring a lot to the table. And if they're not terribly likable, they won't go very far. And I think that's one of the problems that John Kerry had. A very bright man, but not a terribly likable man.
Even when you were next to him, when you could talk to him on a daily basis, you didn't feel the charisma.
He's very reserved, even in a small setting on a campaign airplane late at night when you're at the end of a day and having a beer and talking to the candidate. You didn't feel like you're chatting with a human being. You felt you were interchanging with the candidate.
Who, on the other end of that spectrum, the most affable candidate, the best liked by the press, those who worked closely?
Actually, one of the more likable candidates was Jimmy Carter. One of my favorite stories was one of the very first events I covered was at the VFW hall in Algona, Iowa. I was working for the Fort Dodge Messenger at the time. And the caucus thing was just starting. This was about 1974. And the caucus thing was just starting, and Jimmy Carter was going to appear at a VFW hall in Algona. And so I went up there, and like most VFW halls, the first floor is a bar, and the lower level is a meeting room. So I went down into the meeting room, and there was nobody there. And in walked Jimmy Carter and Jody Powell with no audience. And Jody Powell looked at me and said, "Would you like to interview him?" And I said, "Sure." He said, "Well, let's go upstairs, and you can interview him. And by the way, take your time, and I'll try to go up and down the street and round up a few people to come to the meeting." So I sat and interviewed Jimmy Carter for about half an hour and actually tape recorded it, and actually taped over that recording the next week with an interview I did with an exotic dancer.
What a shame.
I know.
Oh. Any other regrets in your long career besides putting in an exotic dancer, I won't say on top of the president, I will say over the president's recording?
Oh, many, many, many times. There are many, many memories. I can recall leaving once again with Al Gore and his convention in California, and leaving California at about 2 o'clock in the morning California time, flying to Wisconsin, where we were going to float on a boat down the Mississippi River, because those four Midwestern states around the Mississippi River are very, very important electoral states. So we flew into Wisconsin, landed, once again, one of those nights without much sleep, and then got on the boat and were floating down the river when everyone in the press corps discovered there was no cell phone coverage. So having a story about a presidential candidate in your notebook and not being able to get a cell coverage, there was a blind panic, and they eventually managed to contact somebody who brought a speedboat out to take people where they could use their phones.
Mike Glover, my guest for this half hour of River to River, a longtime Associated Press reporter, retired just last month after 36 years of work covering the State House, also covering Iowa politics. In fact, I understand, Mike Glover, that President Obama called to congratulate you on your retirement.
He did. I was actually having lunch with a friend of mine at the historical building out on the patio outdoors, and my phone rang, and this woman said, "Is this Mike Glover?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, this is Helen so-and-so at the White House. Would you hold for the president?" And he came on, was very gracious, congratulated me on my retirement, and asked me what I was going to be doing. We chatted for 5 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, President Obama and I go back a long way. I remember the first time I interviewed him was in Sioux City when he was a long shot, probably not going to get the nomination, a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. And I was at the Hilton. No, it was at the Holiday Inn in Sioux City. And President Obama walked in carrying a suitcase and said, "You're Mike, right?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, we're doing an interview, right?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, let's go in the bar and have a beer and do the interview now." And I said, "Okay." A couple of years ago, I went to a White House holiday reception for the press corps, and I recall talking to people at that reception about the difference between seeing Barack Obama at the Holiday Inn in Sioux City carrying his own suitcase and seeing Barack Obama at the White House with 300 or 400 White House reporters around him. The change is remarkable.
Change in what way? For the better?
Well, just a change. I mean, it's a different sort of a situation he's in now than he was back then.
Mm-hmm. You talked earlier about if you're a politician, you have to be likable. And you pointed to John Kerry as someone who is too reserved. Now, mm-hmm. We have our president currently is often said to be cerebral, but he has the charisma, evidently.
He is cerebral. He's high-minded. He looks at the big picture issues. But also, if you spend any time around Barack Obama, you'll find that he's a fairly affable kind of a person. He's not hard to get along with. He's a very gifted conversationalist, and he has those gifts that good politicians have, which are memory for names and faces and little things about people. And you get a feeling from him that he actually does care about people. And he's one of those people that when you talk to him, you get the feeling that he's actually listening. Now, a lot of politicians you talk to, it's fairly clear from the look on their face they're not really hearing what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Barack Obama, Jimmy Carter having something in common. They came out of Iowa as surprise winners of the Iowa caucuses. Now, you talked about the Iowa caucuses earlier, and really you started your career at the time that the Iowa caucuses started to gain influence in the mid-70s. How have the caucuses influenced our politics in Iowa in the meantime?
They've influenced our politics in the most basic ways possible, and that is that people in Iowa pay attention to politics. Journalists in Iowa write about politics. Politics is an important thing in Iowa that a lot of people pay attention to, and that's not the case in a lot of states. I'm a native of Illinois, and it's a larger state where most people aren't involved in grassroots politics at all. In Iowa, a lot of people are involved in grassroots politics because it's a lot of effort to get them worked up and involved and doing things in politics. So you'll see a greater level of activity, a greater importance placed on politics, and a higher level of activity on all sides.
Mm-hmm. What about at a state level? You've covered politics at the State House in Iowa. What changes have you seen there that stand out most?
Oh, I think one of the changes that has been the most radical, and radical I don't think is too strong a word, is the influence of money on state-level politics, particularly as you boil down to state legislative races, races like that. Those races used to be kind of neighborly. Yeah, there were Republicans and Democrats, and they disagreed and they fought with each other. But at the end of the day, you got the sense that they all went home and went out to dinner. As money has become more and more important in those kind of state house political races, those races have become sharper. They've become hotter. They've become more divisive. People resort to the soundbite. And I recall back when I was first started covering the State House, a couple $1,000s was what people would spend on a competitive House race. Well, that's not the case anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can see in some Senate races, it's not at all unusual to see $500,000 for a state Senate seat that pays less than $30,000 a year. So the money has come in, and I don't think it's really a partisan thing. I think what it is when you put that much effort into trying to get elected, you take it that much more seriously, and it's that much more important to you. And in order to raise the kind of money you need to do those kinds of races, you have to go to the interest groups who are on the extremes on both sides, because they're the ones that have the campaign money.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've tapped them for campaign money, you're beholden to them.
Do you see money becoming more and more a part of politics, this trend continuing, or is there going to be some sort of boomerang where there's a bipartisan, all-party sort of uprising and saying, wait, we've gone too far?
Oh, it's hard for me to see that happening because it's difficult to unilaterally disarm. As soon as you say, well, I'm not going to raise a bunch of money and I'm not going to go to these groups and I'm not going to take the kinds of divisive positions you do, you get killed in an election. At some point, somehow, somebody may win an election without doing that, but it rarely happens. I recall when Mike Mahaffey ran against Leonard Boswell, the first time Leonard Boswell was elected to Congress, they both said they would pride themselves on not running negative campaigns. They both would be positive and not attack each other. At the end of the day, that all fell apart because both political parties wouldn't let them. They said, you've got to do what you got to do to win.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk a little bit about the media. Of course, the print media in very recent years, having a very harsh business climate in which to exist, if I can put it that way. Talk about how your trade, print media, has changed in the years.
Print media, there's an old saying, and if we can focus just for a second on newspapers, Newspapers are based on three economic realities: cheap paper, cheap fuel, and cheap labor. And only one of those things is still cheap. So the basic economics of the American newspaper industry don't work very well now. Paper is very expensive. Fuel is through the roof. So it costs a ton to print and deliver newspapers. And plus, a change in the media and the change in the way people get their information, get their news. There's a generational thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter is in her mid-30s. She and her husband have never subscribed to a newspaper. I mean, they've got laptops, you know, Blackberries, cell phones, all that kind of stuff, and they get their news instantaneously that way. And to them, it doesn't make a lot of sense to wait until morning or afternoon to read
right.
a newspaper we already know.
Who wants to read 11-hour-old news, right?
That's the whole point.
Mm-hmm. How much do you keep up on the latest trends in the news media, social media, and all the things going on these days?
Well, you have to if you want to be in this business at all, because the way we learn things, the way news is communicated, is changing and changing rapidly. Anybody who tells you they know what the American news industry is going to look like in 10 years is lying to you, because
mm-hmm.
None of us know. We know that the American newspaper is not going to continue to exist in the format that it exists in now. We may be at a point where we'll have a few giant national newspapers, the Washington Post and New York Times of the world, and something else that will fill the everyday need. The one thing that I think everybody still yearns for is they want to know what's happening in the community around them. They want to know what's going on in my town. And somebody is going to have to come up with some way of providing that information. And the person who does it comes up with that idea beyond the typical local newspaper is going to be a very rich person.
How has the new technology, the minute-by-minute 24/7 coverage, changed the content of what you as a reporter write?
It's made the job that much tougher, that much more challenging, because there is a demand for instantaneous news. People want to know something exactly as it happens, but there's also a demand for accuracy. And accuracy is, at the end of the day, every bit as important as speed in providing news to people. So striking that balance between being fast and being first and being right is the toughest challenge in the business, and it's getting tougher every day.
You shared some great stories about your coverage of presidential candidates, Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama, John Kerry. In state house politics, do you have any favorite, perhaps crazy, stories around adjournment to share?
Yeah, there was one year, and you'll forgive me if I don't remember the year right off the top of my head, but the last bill that they were debating that year was a bill that would toughen the state's drunk driving laws. And this was about 3 o'clock in the morning as they were struggling to adjourn. They actually used to do that. They don't do that so much anymore. But it was about 3 o'clock in the morning. They were debating a drunk driving bill. A bill making it much tougher penalties for drunk driving. And a drunk driver hit a power pole about a block from the state house and knocked out all electricity to the state house. And so it was in complete darkness. A couple of pages were stuck in an elevator. And the only light they had for about a half an hour was there was actually a television station up there with its Klieg lights on its camera. So they were walking around with the leaders as they negotiated, lighting the stage for them.
And did that change any votes that you know of?
I don't think it changed any votes. The power eventually came back on. The drunk driving law passed, and I don't know what happened to that particular drunk driver.
Mike Glover, what will you be doing now?
Oh, I have several things going. I have some part-time work doing groundskeeping at golf courses in town. I'm a golfer. I enjoy doing that. I have grandchildren not far away, and we like to spend time with them. And I'm doing a little bit of occasionally doing the pickup from school routine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that kind of stuff.
I'm not hearing you mention any writing in there, isn't there?
Well, there is. I will almost certainly write a book, but it's. I'm going to have to be away from it for a month or so and get a little distance and perspective before I do that.
Right. You're early on. You're just in the transition phase right now, aren't you?
I am.
Are you keeping a different schedule, or are you still getting up saying, I've got to to be on top of the news.
Well, once you spend, you know, most of your adult life being on top of the news, you tend to want to stay on top of the news. So I'm still doing that, and I'm still being very active. So it's a nice transition.
You've talked about a lot of things in ways that we can see you will clearly miss them. Are there certain things you will clearly not miss? Glad to say goodbye to.
Actually, one of the things I'm glad to say goodbye to is the travel. I had to, at one point in the 2000 election cycle, had to throw a hissy fit and threaten to resign to get home for my granddaughter's baptism. I won't miss those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Traveling around. Of course, in the internet age, you have to travel less, or do you have to travel just as much as a reporter?
Oh, you have to travel just as much. One of the things that I've learned over the years is you can never cover a story long distance. You have to go there. You have to be there. Whether it's a story within the state or a story outside the state, you've got to be there to see the people, to hear the people. One of the interesting things I had was I took a business course a while back when they talk about email and the shortness of email and how you don't really get what somebody is feeling or thinking when you read an email.
Right,
you can't see their face. You can't see their expression. So you got to be there to actually cover something.
Okay. Mike Glover, thank you for all the wonderful years of covering our news here in Iowa and otherwise in politics. We will miss you.
Thank you.
And we appreciate this conversation this half hour. Associated Press reporter Mike Glover retired last month after 36 years. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble and Jonathan All. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.